Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, calling all parents. Hi, parents. That family vacation, the latest and greatest toys, the new kids' clothes. Do you really, 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 really need them? Maybe not. Given the crazy cost of living these days, maybe you really can't afford them. So what can you cut? What can you cut? Maybe without your kids even noticing. Anita Bruinsma is a personal finance expert, financial coach with Clarity Personal Finance. She'll be here to talk about her tips on how to spend money in more meaningful ways for your kids. Then, we're not a crime show, but we're going to talk a bit about crime today, specifically forensics, forensic accounting, and why some people might turn to using a forensic accountant if they're going through a divorce. Kevin Caspers, managing partner at Caspers Chenaghini, LLP, will be here to tell us more. And the importance of Black-owned banks. I was today years old when I learned about this part of the banking sector in the U.S. I didn't know about it. Lynette Colfani Cox is a personal finance expert, author, speaker. She joins us to give some of the history on Black-owned banks and why they remain a vital resource in the community. Plus, I'll speak with Daryl McMullen, SVP Product and Solutions at MasterCard Canada, about its latest report on tech trends, emerging tech trends, and how they will impact Canadians. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. Here in Canada, we love to complain about the banks. We complain about bank profits. They're too high. We complain about ATM fees, also too high. Bad customer service, too slow. Sales practices, too aggressive. All these things. And still, banks play an incredibly important role in the community for lots and lots of different reasons. In the United States, banks have played, in some areas and in some communities, a very different role throughout history and also in the present. There is a whole category of what are referred to as Black-owned banks. We're joined by Lynette Colfani Cox to talk about that idea. She is the money coach. She is the author of Bounce Back, the Ultimate Guide to Financial Resilience. And she joins us from Houston, Texas. Hello there.
Hi there, Bruce. Thank you so much for having me on. This is an important conversation.
It is. And I really appreciate you joining us to talk about it. I feel like our conversations toggle between past and present with great ease because you have such historical context on things that I'm sure many Americans aren't aware of, but certainly as Canadians, we're just not engaged with the history of how things have unfolded for Black Americans over a course of hundreds of years. So I first want to ask you to tell us about the history of Black-owned banks. Why did they start? Where did they begin?
Well, you know, we all kind of know about at least a little bit about the legacy of slavery in America, right? Where African Americans were subject to chattel slavery for, you know, roughly 250 years. And it wasn't until the end of the Civil War, which was in 1865, remember 1861, 1865 was the Civil War. And then there was the creation of the first Black-owned bank, Freedmen's Bank. Lincoln started that, Congress got together and agreed. And essentially it was a way to just sort of, you know, start things off financially for Black people who had been, of course, very much disenfranchised and would remain so really for, you know, a good 150 years, even after that. Some people say to this day, to a certain extent, we can get a little bit into that. But the idea was that because Black people were not allowed to have ownership or assets or things, it was like, well, of course they don't need banks or bank accounts and financial products or services. So the Freedmen's Bank was the first sort of entree into the banking world for Black people in America.
It has not been an easy history for some of these Black-owned banks. I understand the first or one of the first failed. It was led by white managers. It was not, you would not hold it to the highest standards of business practices that you would today.
Yes, that is correct. And that is the bank that we're talking about, Freedmen's Bank. So ultimately, the bank did fail. And there was, I mean, when I tell you that, we in the African American community sometimes say that Black people have a long memory, especially for historical events that have happened, but where the history has been passed along and handed down. You might have heard your grandmother or your great grandmother talk about something. So we went through this era, of course, of not having sort of any more legalized discrimination or exclusion to this period, you know, post-Civil War Reconstruction era, where there was still a lot of efforts made to disenfranchise and to hold back African Americans economically. So you mentioned that, yes, the board, that white board, even though it was supposed to be, again, for the interests of and kind of in care of Black people, white, essentially, executives made a whole bunch of bad decisions, and the bank failed and went under. And so many Black people lost everything in that bank at the time. Now, again, we're going back, you know, over a century. But I don't have to take you back, you know, too far to really think about the ways in which we all, no matter our background or ethnicity, have heard stories of things that went right in a family or things that went wrong, right? So my mom is 80 years old. My mom was born in 1943. And she remembers a lot from her father, who was in Tennessee, and who basically had to escape, you know, to the north to not have to deal with racism and the threat of violence being put upon him. So his personal, his banking and his financial experiences were very much rooted in this country's, you know, sort of this concept that Black people would not be on equal footing, not socially, not economically, not politically, and certainly not financially as well.
We have covered on this show racism within Canadian financial institutions. I'm sure it's in lots of different places that remain hidden from view, but there are also some very prominent examples of people of color receiving service that would, you know, shock the white majority. They wouldn't understand how they could be treated so poorly. Tell us a bit about Black-owned banks in today's context. What role do they play?
Well, we do have a couple dozen Black-owned banks that still exist today, but unfortunately the numbers have dwindled dramatically. And it's for a whole host of reasons. Disinvestment in various communities, a lack of support at many levels, and then, frankly, an inability to be able to sort of get things going in a way that would generate deposits or confidence in some cases. So we do have some national banks in terms of them operating at scale. But for the most part, many are CDFIs, community depository financial institutions. They serve more regional or local members of the community. But there are, again, a couple that are sort of national in scope, City First, One United, et cetera, have national customer base. And they do a great job, I think, of offering not only access to products and services, checking accounts, savings, mortgages, loans, things of that nature, but they're also filling the gap in a lot of ways because these minority serving institutions, these minority depository institutions, as well as their credit union brethren, I should mention, because there are also Black owned credit unions, right. They really do fill a need in communities that are marginalized, that are underserved, and that are historically low to moderate income.
I'm glad you mentioned credit unions because we have a very strong credit union sector here in Canada. Many were grounded in a particular demographic, like, you know, Dutch immigrants or people who belong to this particular union, and they have an expertise and an affinity for that demographic that really informs client service and the product offering. And in fact, at the source of a lot of innovations in the Canadian sector, because they were able to target a need. When you look ahead, what do you see is the future of the Black-owned banks in America?
Well, I would hope that they would gain in prominence, viability, and strength. We know that compared to majority institutions, whether that's a B of A, a Chase, a Citi, the asset base is very tiny, dare I say minuscule, by comparison. I think, as a matter of fact, at Citi First, which is now the largest Black-owned bank in America, they merged in 2021 with Broadway Federal. They're now the largest, and they have assets of over $1 billion. But you look at, Chase, or again, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, take your pick. And we're talking about many hundreds of billions or trillions in terms of, kind of asset base and depository structure that's underpinning them. So I would hope, though, that we would see more support. And there is the National Black Bank Foundation, which is an organization that does provide operational and expert legal and organizational support to Black-owned banks. But it's also going to be incumbent upon institutions and individuals to make these banks stay alive and to be able to serve their purpose. And I should mention, Bruce, that sometimes people hear the phrase and the term Black-owned bank and they think, oh, okay, well, that's only a bank for Black people. No, that's not the case, actually. So when we say Black-owned bank, what that really refers to is an institution, a for-profit institution in the banking world that has members or customers or a board of directors that is predominantly Black. In many cases, though, they might also have the customer base is predominantly Black, as in the for-profit institutions or the not-for-profit Black-owned credit unions. But we certainly have many allies and, again, non-Black people, institutions can and do provide support to Black-owned financial institutions. For example, Netflix put a sizable amount of funds on deposit, the company Netflix, with Black-owned institutions. Last year, the NFL, the National Football League, borrowed about 78 million or so from Black-owned banks. Again, these were gestures of support and ways to do business with these Black-owned firms and to kind of, by example, illustrate that and hope that other institutions would also come to the table and do likewise.
One last question before we go. As you say, market share wise, the Black-owned banks are small compared to the massive institutions. I think it is fair to say that there exists a legacy of systemic racism globally, not just in America. If there was one or two things that you would put out to the universe to say would really make a difference on eradicating systemic racism as it relates to financial institutions, what would be one or two things that you would ask the universe to provide?
Ooh, that's a weighty and a good question. I guess what I would start with is a truth sort of commission. You know, I don't think that we can adequately move forward with the so-called original sin in America, the racism problem that was rooted in slavery, until there is an acknowledgement of what took place. And unfortunately, we're seeing a backlash right now in America. It's the exact opposite. There is a clamping down on DEI and diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. There are efforts to not teach the history in schools. And as a result, not only can we not even have an honest conversation about what took place and the ways in which it still has widespread ramifications today, then we can't get to part two, since you asked me about what were the two things I would say. The second thing is reparations is a redress. You fix harm. You know, if you bang up somebody's car, you would get out of the vehicle and say, "Oh my gosh, I'm sorry," and pull out your insurance card. And then if you were in the wrong, your insurance company would pay to fix that other person's vehicle. You don't just get to say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I hit your car," and then just drive off and walk away. It's an incomplete, part of the situation if you only acknowledge, "Oopsie, I did hit your car." Yep. And so a lot of African Americans, myself included, feel like, one, there's not been yet the acknowledgement. The truth is not being told, let alone getting to that part of, what do we do about this? How do we put this to bed once and for all?
Yeah. Very interesting, Lynette. I really appreciate your time and your wisdom on this topic. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce.
Lynette Colfani-Cox is the money coach and the author of Bounce Back, The Ultimate Guide to Financial Resilience. She was here to talk to us about Black-owned banks. Coming up next on Moolala, kids are expensive. How to spend money on your children in meaningful ways while also cutting costs. Anita Bruinsma, financial coach with Clarity Personal Finance, shares her tips. And later, Daryl McMullen, SVP Product and Solutions at MasterCard in Canada, tells us about their Emerging Tech Trends report and how it will impact Canadians. If you like what you heard today, you can make sure you hear more episodes of Moolala. How you can do that is you can do one of two things. Go to the website, moolala.ca. You can search by topic, by guest, listen to past episodes. You can also go to any of the podcast platforms and do the same. So Spotify, Amazon Prime, Apple Music. And while you're there, subscribe so future episodes just arrive right to your device. Moolala Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. Raising a child is really expensive these days, really expensive. There is a lot to pay in terms of the needs, like the basics of, you know, food and clothing. And there is a lot to pay dependent on the wants of your kid and also your wants for your kid. So there's a lot of advice around this, a lot of pressure to spend money on certain things like birthday parties and technology and vacations and all that. How do you strike the balance here? Our next guest is Anita Bruinsma. She is a financial coach with Clarity Personal Finance, and she is the parent of two teenage boys. So she has the cred on these conversations. She recently wrote a piece for the Globe and Mail headlined "Five Places Parents Can Cut Costs and the Kids Won't Even Notice." She joins us now to talk about her view and the kinds of questions that she asks of parents as we think about our children. So Anita, hello, welcome.
Thank you, Bruce. Nice to be here.
I have a 14-year-old. Your column struck me because of what you said about the kids not even noticing. And I think that's so great because when I reflect on the birthday parties that we hosted for my kid when they're like three or four, they didn't care. But I cared about what the other parents thought about the birthday party that I was hosting. So how do you frame this question about what we should be spending our money on when it comes to our kids?
Well, as you say, Bruce, a lot of what we spend money on isn't so much driven by our children, but it's actually driven by our own feelings. And I think there are some things that contribute to that. So the first thing is, you know, when you have a baby, of course, that's super exciting, right? So you walk through Babies R Us and you want to buy all the stuff and you don't really know what you're going to need. And you have, you know, 9 months to buy all kinds of stuff. And so I think that's where it starts, is right away you have a new category of spending in your budget that you didn't have before. And it's very, very exciting. And then as your kids grow up, they keep reaching these new ages and stages where now you can buy them a tricycle and then you can buy them a skateboard and a bike. And then it's, you know, as you get teenagers, it's phones and laptops. And so there's always a reason to spend. And I think what you mentioned earlier about the competition to me is a really important component of this question. And so parents really need to ask themselves, why am I having those birthday parties, going on those vacations, buying my kids the super cute Nikes when they're babies? And I think a lot of it is that we feel like we see other parents doing it. And, you know, we want to be a good parent and we want other people to think we're good parents. And so you really need to ask yourself that question, who am I doing it for?
Your first topic in your article was around birthday parties. And I thought, yeah, I if I had a do-over, I could have pulled back on that. The second one, though, is delaying vacations. And on that one, I feel like, wait a sec, that would be a sacrifice for me because I really enjoyed those vacations. So tell me how that works.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will ask you this question, Bruce. When you were on a plane with a two-year-old,
oh my God,
would you say that that's a sacrifice to give that up?
The plane ride for sure, but the arrival of the destination and being sleep deprived with sand and sun, that part was worth it. That mm-hmm. part was worth it.
Okay. So you feel that way. I'm not sure I necessarily felt that way. You know, I think some parents do it because they feel like they want to give their kids exposure to vacations. They want to share the joy that they've always felt with vacations. And also for some people, they feel it's educational. I'm going to bring my kids to see Paris, or they're going to see another culture and they're going to experience life. And I think that's great. Except if you were to ask your children if they remember any of your vacations under the age of five, I'm going to guess for sure they're not going to remember them.
None. They might remember their secondary experience of flipping through the photo album, but not
exactly.
the primary memory of the vacation.
Which is important. I would agree. Sure. But, you know, in my experience, when I talk to my children about the vacations we've been on, anything before the age of nine, they're sort of like, I don't really remember that trip. But from nine onwards, to me, the golden age of traveling with your kids is like 9 to 15, because you can take them somewhere, they can absorb everything, they're a little more independent, your life is easier. And when you reflect on your vacations, for sure, they're going to remember those fun times. And honestly, if you take them somewhere educational, they're going to have learned something and they're going to have be exposed to another environment. So I really believe that, you know, if you want to do it for yourself, that's one thing. And let's face it, as we said at the beginning, a lot of these things we do for ourselves. And so as a parent, you would ask yourself, you know, is this really, really important to me that I go on vacation? Or is it okay that I leave the kid at home with a grandparent and we go on vacation?
Yes. Oh, yes. Your third point was about limiting the number of toys and books that you buy, which makes sense, again, if you park the emotion out of it. And what one of the traps that we have fallen into is this idea of volume. So on birthdays, on Christmases, it needs to look like a certain size when it comes to the number of things that they're unwrapping. How do you get around that?
So when I was growing up, I grew up in a four children family on one income. And we had one gift for Christmas. Mm. And if I think about the experience of my children who had a pile of gifts under the tree versus my experience of getting one gift, I'm not sure really it was that much different, because it's about the anticipation. It's about the experience of unwrapping it. It's the sitting together as a family and putting on the music and unwrapping your presents. Or for your birthday, it's the excitement of unwrapping it. So, you know, one of my tips would be make the experience of receiving the gift more exciting. You know, maybe it's a lot, you got to find the gift. Sometimes we've done things where we have questions and they have to go around the house finding it. And so they're only getting one gift, but it's actually really, really exciting. But I think part of the problem is that we've built up this expectation, and all the, you know, commercials show the Christmas tree that's got all these gifts under it. I just think if you moved your children away from that sort of thinking, especially at a young age, I'm not sure that they would miss it so much. And I think this is the key, Bruce, though, is like, I wish I'd known these things 17 years ago. I learned them as I went along. If a parent can understand, let's set the expectation from the beginning that we're not going to have a mound of gifts under the tree, then quite honestly, I think the kids won't even miss it.
Yeah. Don't get sucked into buying fancy kids' clothing was another one of yours. This one was easy for me because I am not a shopper. I don't care about the clothing. I was perfectly happy with hand-me-downs. But mm-hmm. for a lot of people, their self-concept is that it matters to them, not just what they look like, but what their kid looks like.
Definitely. And I was a shopper back then when my kids were little. And I love nothing more than looking at all the super cute clothes and imagining how adorable my child's going to look in them. And especially, you know, these days compared to when we were young, designer companies are now creating clothing for babies. So you can get the tiny Adidas shoes or the little Nike shoes, which quite honestly, Bruce, how many times are they going to wear them? Like three times before they grow out of them?
And they'll have kicked them off before.
And they've lost them. Yes, they're somewhere out down the street. So for sure, the hand-me-downs is one option. But even just thinking about the idea of like, what does a baby actually need? You know, they need comfy clothes that are easy to get off, easy to change, easy to wash. You might be doing more laundry if you have fewer clothes, but it's certainly going to be a lot easier. And the clothing swap is great. If there's someone in your neighborhood who has a kid who's, you know, 6 or 12 months older than yours, taking their hand-me-downs, I'm sure they'd love to get them off their plate. And that's something that I did a lot, especially with my relatives.
What would you say about the context for this conversation? Because I can imagine if your context for money is we got all the money in the world, it's totally fine. We're saving for retirement. We're paying our mortgage. Then have at her, do all those things. But that is not the circumstance for so many Canadians right now because it is so, so difficult for people to make ends meet.
Absolutely. So if you have the money and if it makes you happy to spend on those things, I say fine. But, you know, the question you need to think about is, am I spending that money consciously or am I just doing it without thinking? Because conscious spending is really the core of any sort of smart budgeting and smart planning. Because a budget is great, but what you really need to do is you need to believe in the budget and you need to believe in how you're spending money and how it makes you happy. And so for those people for whom life is expensive and they don't have a lot of money floating around, it's looking at all those different items in your life and prioritizing them. Which things in my budget are going to make us really happy and which things in our budget are, you know, we're not even noticing that we're spending it. It's not adding to our happiness. So where do we really want to funnel that money? And quite honestly, you know, not spending $400 on a birthday party is probably a really good place to start.
Yeah. Closer to six these days, I will say.
Six. Thank you.
Yeah, it's insane. So just before we go here, as a financial coach, you work with individuals and families and you get right into the numbers here. This is a big word, but do you require that they put in a line item on kids' education, retirement savings, before they then look at what's discretionary that they can spend on the vacations and the clothes? I say require with air quotes, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. The way that I like to approach the budgeting is to start with all the needs. So we take your inflow, what's your cash coming in? Take off your deductions and taxes. Then what are your needs? Your rent, utilities, all the things you absolutely have to have. And then after that, you have the chunk of discretionary funds left over, disposable income. Then we set the savings goals, the education savings, the retirement, and then what's left after that. And that is what gets allocated to that discretionary spending. Now, that's an ideal world, right? Like ideally, it would be that way. The reality is very different. Parents are busy. They're working. They're exhausted. And there are times when they're just going to spend money in panic mode because they need to solve an immediate problem, be that my kid's not sleeping, I need a sleep machine, or be it, you know, I don't feel like making dinner, we're going to order Uber Eats. So there is a reality. So you need to have a buffer there. But I certainly like to at least have some kind of savings plan in place before you go and spend on all the other discretionary items.
Well, Anita, lots of food for thought. And like you, I wish I'd had that conversation even more clearly and more often when my kid was young, because there were places that in hindsight, I just wouldn't have spent. Thank you for your time today.
You're very welcome.
Anita Bruinsma is a financial coach with Clarity Personal Finance. And she joined us to talk about a piece she wrote for The Globe, headlined Five Places Parents Can Cut Costs Where Your Kids Won't Even Notice. Coming up later, MasterCard's Emerging Tech Trends Report with Daryl McMullen from MasterCard Canada. But first, money and divorce. In some cases, there are hidden assets, hidden income, crime, wrongdoing. We're going to talk to Kevin Kaspers, managing partner at Kaspers Cegini, about forensic accounting and what it may uncover during a divorce. Unhappier thoughts, food, fashion, fun, design. CityLine is the place for inspiration in all of those areas. It is Canada's longest running daily lifestyle show. And I am so lucky that I get to be the money columnist over there. So if you want to learn more about the things that we talk about on CityLine, their website is cityline.tv. Search my name. I've got lots of personal finance advice over there with a little, tiny little dose of levity and fun.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
When you hear the word forensics, you probably think of like a cops and robbers TV show or like CSI, Law and Order, something like that. It is a word that is featured in a lot of TV dramas out there. It is a word that plays prominently in some family dramas sometimes, in that forensic accounting can be a part of the divorce process for some families. Not in most cases, but in some. And that, of course, would relate to personal finances, which is why we're talking about it here. Our guest is Kevin Caspers, managing partner at Caspers Cheghini LLP. He joins us from Vaughan, Ontario. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
I am well. I had to look up the word forensic to see what it actually meant. But in the context of accounting, how do you define it?
I mean, it's funny that you were making a reference to what most people think of forensic when they hear that word, you know, like the physical crime scene investigation. I guess in this instance, the simplest way to put it is it's the almost like the financial equivalent of that. Looking at relevant financial numbers, figures, and then putting those together to sort of figure out the big picture, the full picture.
In the very simplest of divorce cases, there are some bank statements, there's the value of the home, it's all very simple. What are some things that people in a relationship that is dissolving could be hiding that forensic accounting might help discover?
The first instance where a forensic accountant might be required is where one of the parties is self-employed, owns their own business. They're very much in control of their professional financial circumstances. So in that sort of situation, there might be some concern as to what that party is doing with respect to their business. Is their income accurately being reflected? Are they moving, you know, these business funds in another direction, hiding them somewhere, etc., because they have so much control of that business, there might be some concern in that sense, and then thus a forensic accountant might be required to suss it out.
What about things like real estate or business interests that might not be declared? What would fit in that category?
So it's tricky. The more time a party has to, say, hide their assets, move their assets, this kind of thing, the better they are able to hide them. It's very hard for a forensic accountant, for example, to find something where there's absolutely no trace. Now, as part of a divorce procedure, divorce matter, if we're talking about the division of assets, that's worldwide assets, right? So for all we know, if I provide you, Bruce, with a financial statement and I'm listing my accounts and I have an account in, say, India or, you know, somewhere in South America, how are you to know that I've excluded that particular account on my financial statement? And unless there is a tidbit, you know, a little nugget that suggests, you know, a transfer or money coming in from this account that hasn't been accounted for, Then it's time, you know, then we can get the forensic accountant to kind of follow that nugget. But if you don't have that, it's very hard to find those kinds of assets.
So let's say there is the nugget. How do they do their work? What are they able to uncover? What are they able to, I don't even know if this is the right word, subpoena?
Right. So, I mean, they would almost go what you say, go down that rabbit hole. Okay. So where does this nugget lead? What does this account tie to? Okay. Then we then need statements for that particular account, or as you might have mentioned earlier, a property, some hint of a property in another jurisdiction. And they will try and get as much information following that path, going down that rabbit hole that they can, in order to get, like I said, the full picture. What is that property? When was it acquired? What was the value of it? You know, when was this account set up? How much was in it? Was it, did it increase in value? Was money taken out, moved somewhere else, et cetera, et cetera. They will, try to get as much information as possible to build that picture.
What are my rights? Let's say this is my soon to be former spouse, and I have suspicions about what assets they have, what their income has been. What am I allowed to see? What am I allowed to ask? What accounts am I allowed to access?
There's certain requirements under the Family Law Act as to what should be produced. You know, it starts with things, what we would call basic disclosure, like, you know, tax returns, notices of assessment, credit card statements and bank statements for the last 3 years. That it essentially would support your financial statement that you're providing. But if that leads to, like I said, some sort of inquiry that needs to happen. Well, we don't know how much was, you know, there's a large amount that was transferred out a couple of years ago and we don't know where it went. A further investigation might be needed to clarify that. And you're certainly entitled to have a full understanding of what the financial circumstances are. But I caveat that, you know, however the marriage or relationship was set up, for example, you, Bruce, are going to be in charge of managing the household finances. I'm good with that. And I trust you to do that. And I'm going to do something else, maybe, you know, take care of the kids or take care of, you know, what have you. And then when at the time of separation, because of my ignorance, I can't simply go on a fishing expedition based on suspicion because I have not been up to date or been made aware of how the finances have been managed throughout our relationship. So there has to be some reason why you're asking for certain things.
There is a fair amount of mistrust often when marriages end. I am sure you have a lot of clients who just have this sneaking suspicion that all is not disclosed. What guidance would you have for them in terms of whether or not they should retain the services of a forensic accountant, whether it's going to be worth it to do that, both in terms of the cost and also the potential negative effect on the other party?
No, that's really the crux of the assessment is, what am I looking for? And is there a basis to what I'm looking for? And then two, is it proportional? Because a forensic accountant can be very expensive. They're performing a complex and in-depth financial investigation. So if you're chasing, even if you're suspicious and there's a hint of, you know, $20,000, $30,000, does it really make sense to incur $100,000 investigation to really get to the bottom of it? So you first have to have that proportionality, right? How much do I suspect is not being reflected here? How much am I chasing versus how much it's going to cost me in forensic accounting fees to actually get to the bottom of it? Second of all, I go back to that original question is there actually the nugget there, you know, showing you, giving you the basis for your suspicion that you should be chasing something and having a forensic accountant assist you in doing so?
In what percentage of cases? I assume it is low, but I don't know if it's like 1 in 100 or 1 in 10,000.
I mean, I don't have the statistics, so I can certainly speak from just my experience and what I've heard, at least in my 10 years in family law. I spoke earlier about one of the parties having a business. Generally, you will involve what's called a chartered business valuator to look into that business to, like I said, ensure the party's income is accurately reflected for support purposes, or that if the business is subject to equalization, division of matrimonial assets, if you will, that the value of the business is accurate, this kind of thing. That is very common. That is a very common use of forensic accounting in valuating a business and valuating an income for a self-employed individual. Beyond that, when we start talking about this real in-depth forensic accounting, chasing statements, going back historically to look at transactions, maybe looking at even lifestyle, if the party has a large cash income, they want to compare the lifestyle to what they're saying their income is, and if that is commensurate. These kinds of investigations, very rare. I only had an instance where it almost happened, and it just turned out not to be proportional because, again, how much are you actually chasing at the end of the day?
Just one last question before we go here. What would be two or three tips for the DIY of forensic accounting? So you're not going to hire the firm, but as a person in a marriage that is ending, some things that you could keep in mind or look for to ensure that there is, as best as you can hope for, full disclosure on both sides.
So
without going through waste paper baskets and, you know, Facebook.
Right. Account. Which certainly happens. But that's a good question, because I think the lawyers, the attorneys essentially have to do a bit of, do it yourself accounting, forensic accounting, because they want to assist their clients in making that determination. So a family lawyer will generally look at those kinds of statements, whatever financial disclosure has been produced, to see if, you know, do the statements, do the supporting documentation correspond and match up with the financial statement. Okay, so the supporting documentation supports what's been, you know, written and support and disclosed in the party's financial statement. Then from there, does the income support the expenses? Right. Well, if someone has expenses of, you know, $100,000, $200,000 above their income, well, how are they covering that if there's no debt? So these kinds of little things that don't match up throughout the financial information that's provided at the basic level can then lead you down to that necessity for a forensic accountant.
Really interesting stuff. I hope for the majority of our listeners, they are fascinated by this topic, but we'll never have to do anything about it. Kevin,
agreed.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Bruce.
Kevin Caspers, managing partner at Caspers Cheghini, LLP. We were talking about the role of forensic accounting and its potential use in cases of divorce. Coming up, three emerging tech trends expected to reshape the world of commerce. Daryl McMullen, SVP Product and Solutions at MasterCard in Canada, takes us through this report and the details. And get inspired to get a better handle on your money. You can sign up for the Moolala newsletter. Simple tips, tricks, advice that we are talking about on CBC, on Cityline, BNN Bloomberg, here on SiriusXM. To sign up for that newsletter, go to moolala.ca. We send it out like once a month. And we never, ever, ever do anything with your email address other than send you that newsletter. Are you struggling with debt? Feeling like no matter what you do, you just can't get on top of it? Maybe you're nervous, but feeling like you're almost ready to take control of your financial future. Introducing Credit Canada Goal, an innovative, holistic financial coaching program designed to help you get out of debt and back into life. Credit Canada Gold takes place virtually over 6 weeks and includes live class sessions, group coaching, homework, and an accountability buddy. It's intense, but the results are amazing. And if you're accepted into the program, your tuition is covered by a scholarship, so it won't cost you a thing. Visit creditcanada.com/gold to learn more and apply for one of our upcoming programs. Take control and transform your financial future with Credit Canada Gold. The world of commerce is changing. There is so much going on. The world of technology is changing. So much going on. There was a recent report from MasterCard that focused on three emerging tech trends that are expected to reshape, change, alter, transform a whole bunch of different sectors. So we thought, hey, that's an interesting thing for us to think about from a personal finance perspective. To talk about this, we're joined by Daryl McMullen, SVP Product and Solutions at MasterCard Canada. He's in Toronto today. Hello there.
Great to chat with you, sir. How you been?
I am well. I'm sure we could talk about this for hours. Three trends outlined in your report: AI, that we talk about a lot these days, computational power. I kind of think that's the difference between my Commodore 64 and my, you know, laptop today, and data technologies, which is a very ambiguous term. I want to start with number two, because that's the one that I think we know the least about. What do you mean when you use the phrase computational power?
It covers a number. You're right. That is a broad-based term as well. And you might even think off the top, what is a company like MasterCard thinking about stuff like that, being a typically known as a credit card company? And yes, payments perhaps are at our core, but if you think of us as a network, our real focus of excellence are on kind of three key areas, one being data analytics, one on cybersecurity, and real-time secured authentication and connectivity. Our demands in the digital world continue to accelerate. The number of transactions that we do digitally has exponentially grown, every time we do something. And every time we do a transaction, people think, oh, it's just a transaction. Well, every transaction generates, 15 to 30 different data points and the relationships around that. So when you go back to computing power, part of it is gathering all of the data that comes in, what is the experiences that can be augmented and changed as a part of that? So part of that could be related to fraud and security. Part of that could be related to upfront around things like loyalty. One of the big trends that we're seeing when it comes to computational power, and it kind of interrelates with artificial intelligence and data, all three are interrelated. When you think about ads today, people don't run like one ad campaign, or they run A, B, and see which one is best. Ads now are hyper-personalized. Mm-hmm. When a company does a campaign, they'll do thousands of versions of that ad. And that goes through a whole bunch of computational understanding on how they augment an experience. How they talk to you might be very different than how they talk to me versus how they very differently talk to your sister. And then when we think of interfaces, they're changing as well, right? And we're starting to see a little bit more, obviously things like Apple Glasses and the metaverse have been their infancy in terms of experiential type things. And they're still a little bit in the kind of sandbox gadget type vibe. But some of the things that we're seeing, even in our own alpha labs, around how do you merge the in-store experience with the digital experience, that's going to be here before we know it in a lot of different, right?
I'm sure. I throw on my kids' Oculus and I'm just blown away by how that technology can make such a big difference. And I can see it making a big difference in people's experiences in so many ways, consuming, commerce, shopping included. Data technologies sounds like a very, very broad theme. What do you mean specifically about data technologies, and how could that manifest for consumers?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple different things there. So one is, I would say, the tokenization of everything. Most people are even as general consumers may understand the concept of a token, where you take your physical credit card and you create a digital version of it on your phone. Right. So that way you can just walk around and tap your phone. What you've essentially done is created a secured, encrypted digital token on your phone, and you're using your own biometric to authenticate yourself, without sounding super geeky, but that's essentially what that is. If you take that same concept and start tokenizing everything else that's out there in a number of different ways for people's value and benefit, I would say kind of early days, if you think of things that are still in the kind of prehistoric era, identity, right? And I would say that's the one layer that's broken when in the internet and commerce is identity. We have government issued identity, but it's still in the kind of physical card form. Whenever you're having to authenticate yourself, it's very difficult, and you have to go through a number of different passwords and knowledge-based questions and answers. Well, what if you could actually have all of your identity tokenized and secured, encrypted for you as well? So your driver's license can verify your address, you can verify your birthday, all of that information very securely, and a more seamless experience.
I was the victim of identity theft about 18 months ago, and the fraudster, all they had to do to set me up for a massive hit to my credit score and almost 9 months of grief was my name and address. They got a credit card shipped to a branch. They never picked it up, but because it had an annual fee, which I did not pay because I didn't order the card and didn't know about it, I took a massive hit to my score. Why are we seeing a lag in those kinds of identity verification measures that seem so simple?
Yeah, well, I think it's two pieces there. There's one, just tokenizations. We are seeing that start to proliferate a little bit more, whether it be identity, whether that be loyalty. And you'll see a lot of changes in the modernization of loyalty in that way. Part of it is related to authentication layers up front and standards that everyone can agree on. Even when it comes to identity, you know, there's, you know, different provincial standards on driver's licenses and health cards and state licenses. There are new tokenized standards that are coming. So it doesn't matter if you have a Georgia state driver's license or an Ontario driver's license, you should be able to use that at the same place and within the same structure and format, so you don't have to validate yourself in different ways.
I bring two perspectives to all the conversations we have about personal finance on this show and in other places too. And that is, we want commerce to be productive and efficient and at the lowest cost possible, like so many virtuous things that are helpful when we innovate on that front. But the second perspective is, we know that the use of credit cards has anesthetized the pain of spending and have reduced so much of the friction with spending, because you can just tap or swipe and they already know your credit card, versus, oh my God, I got to trek to the store with cash in hand in order to transact. Where is the innovation out there that will help save Canadians from themselves when it comes to overspending? I want to slow this train down in many regards. And I'll say that the catalyst to this particular question is 35% of credit cards in use are not paid off in full. And a part of that, maybe it's a small part, but a part of that is it's so easy to spend.
Yeah. So I think it's a great question. Some of the ways to look at that, and it talks about, or similar to what I was talking about earlier, where there is so much data that surrounds every transaction that you do. And going back to, how do we now start taking a lot of that data to provide meaningful insights back to a user in real time, right? So it could be, here's your spending patterns. Oh, here, you're over budget if you've set budgets for yourself, or identifying transactions in real time that are a little odd or weird. And this is where it kind of dovetails in the conversation around, what's the role that artificial intelligence perhaps playing in having intelligent agents, if you will, that are able to identify, hey, Bruce, you're spending a little too much this month, or if you're trying to set limits for yourself, what role they can play on financial management in some way that's a lot more intelligent than, you know, historically looking at just investment quarterly statements.
the technology and the innovation is going to be there. We can't stop it. AI in particular feels like both magic and also this horrendous curse that we're inflicting on ourselves in some ways. How do we ensure that the consumer's interests are served? Because listen, I have a background as a packaged goods marketer. I was all about selling the stuff, whether you needed it or not. I was about selling the stuff. And I would love an AI application that would shake me awake and say, dude, you cannot afford that because of X, Y, and Z. But I don't know why a for-profit enterprise would ever institute a prompt like that, because by the very nature of their business, they're about making more money, which, by the way, I have no problem with, but it doesn't serve the consumer sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I think if we kind of take an elevation step back and think of, you know, the last 20 years has been the massive scale of information at our fingertips. And with information and opportunity comes temptation to spend and buy, right? And we're still we're consumed with all of this information all the time. And if you think of like traditional even search engines, right, they're just indexing all of that information for you. When you go to a commerce website, there's still like electronic catalogs of information that you can browse through. Generative AI, you know, what traditional search engines are to information, AI is to answers, right? So being able to wade through those search results, search engines put pages in front of you, and commerce sites put, you know, content and products in front of you and gives you all the justifications and reasons on why to buy them. But generative AI can act more as like a study partner or a financial partner in many ways. These digital agents can help people both on a personal level and a professional level as well. We're starting to see some people use generative AI almost as chief marketing officers or chief financial officers. Not that you would wholly own the entire responsibility onto them, but as a sanity check, how does this look? How does that look? How can we make this better? And have an ongoing conversation to be able to evaluate and provide the context and intention to what to everything that you're doing.
One last question before we go, Daryl. If you were to think about one particular technology application that you believe we will see in the next 5 years that will make the biggest difference for individuals when it comes to their personal finances, when it comes to their money, what would that be?
Well, I think it's the combination of a couple of things, right? So I do think AI, the thing is, I don't think AI is a product, first of all, right? I think AI is a bloodline and a connective point to a lot of other elements that are around there. Our financial lives are more complex than they've ever been. People have multiple credit cards. They have multiple banking relationships, multiple investment relationships. It's tough to make sense of it all. And trying to put it all into spreadsheets doesn't make sense. That's almost a full-time job. Yeah. So the idea of having intelligent agents, whether that be on managing your personal finances, personal financial management has been a long promise forever, right? Early days of things like, you know, personal financial software or people managing things on spreadsheets, but that's just tracking stuff. Yeah. Having an actual financial management and a financial agent can definitely help optimize things. I think there are other categories. You think of travel, right? And going back to what I was saying earlier, we went from, you know, 20 years ago dealing with travel agents, to then the internet comes along, everything became self-service, and you're inundated with so many options for booking flights, for booking resorts, all that sort of stuff. It's almost overwhelming at some point. I actually think we're going to see a renaissance of a travel agent, but virtual. Right. Yeah. So when I'm going to book a trip to Scotland this summer, it's done very efficiently. And you use generative AI to actually book a trip and say that you want to, you know, say a 3-day trip through Scotland, and I want to stop at these three places. Oh, and my partner's vegan. Give me two options for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And what are their best dishes to have?
Yeah.
That can be done in seconds, right? Yeah. So there's a lot of that sort of the role of how AI actually optimizes the content around us.
Interesting. Daryl, thanks for your insight on this. We could talk about it for hours. I appreciate you carving off a few minutes to be with us today.
Pleasure to.
Daryl McMullen, Senior Vice President, Product and Solutions at MasterCard Canada. That's it for our show today. A thanks to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. To get in touch with us for any reason, comments, questions, story ideas, feedback, our email address is ask@moolala.ca. Ask@moolala.ca. As I mentioned earlier, you can subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca. You can subscribe to the podcast on any of the podcast platforms out there. And while you're there, leave us a review. On social media, I am at Bruce Selry on X, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for listening and have a great day.